Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lelchuk. We hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Now, if you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much, much more. Remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. Here's Daniel Lelchuk.
On today's program, the 100th episode of Talking Beats, historian and best-selling writer Neil Ferguson. He's a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and served for 12 years as the Lawrence Tisch Professor of History at Harvard. He's the author of more than 15 major books on the history of both Europe and America. These include The Pity of War, Explaining World War I, The House of Rothschild, How Institutions Decay and Economies Die, and Empire, How Britain Made the Modern World. His most recent book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe, in which he poses tough questions about our ability as a society to deal with disaster, be it a wildfire or a pandemic. This isn't just a history, but a general theory of disaster. But somehow, we started on a lighter note, as you'll hear talking about music, live music, and recordings of classical music. Here's my distinguished guest, Neil Ferguson.
And I think I read somewhere an opera company had the chorus wearing N95 masks, and a little part of me died when I read that.
A large part of me died when you just said that. but contrary to the beauty and the joy of playing live concerts for real people, you happen to have written a book recently called Doom. The subtitle is The Politics of Catastrophe, and as much as I'd love to chat about music with you, maybe we'll go back to that later, we should touch on this a little bit. So why did you want to write this book? Why Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe? Haven't we had enough doom? Not that it's your job to cheer us all up, but really.
Well, it is a cheering book, actually, Daniel, because the point of the book was to try to put recent events in some kind of historical perspective. And when you do that, you realize, first of all, how much worse this could have been compared with the 1918-19 influenza. This is not a top 10 pandemic in global history. And indeed, compared with most really major pandemics of the recent past, it had the distinguishing feature that it spared the young. And there really is a big difference to the experience of a pandemic if it's overwhelmingly the elderly who are dying prematurely. In 1957-58, which was a comparable pandemic, the excess mortality was highest amongst teenagers. So part of the point of writing it was to help get this catastrophe into perspective. And part of the point was also to try to learn some usable lessons, because we don't want to screw up the next disaster that befalls us. And we need to learn some intelligent lessons from what has gone wrong. We also need to ask whether we've been handling disasters rather badly recently, not just this pandemic, but if you look back over 20 years, one could hardly say that we did a brilliant job after 9/11 or that we did a brilliant job of managing the financial crisis. Very different kinds of disaster. But the point of the book is to bring all the different types of disaster under one roof into a single volume and offer a general theory of disaster and some lessons to help us manage the next one better, because there will be another one. Disasters aren't about to be stopped. You can't prevent them. The question is, can you get better at reacting to them?
Drill down on this point, which is a big point of the book, that there are many kinds of disasters, and just because we're coming out of a pandemic now doesn't mean we should only be thinking about the next pandemic. There are so many things, sadly, that can go wrong. I can fall off my bike, or you know, you can slip in the shower, or we can be in a sort of world war and anything in the middle. how do we, as a society, how do the people, quote, in charge, spread their wings broadly enough that they're covering the bases that you think need to be covered?
I think it is really important to recognize the wide range of risks and uncertainties that we confront. And that requires a breadth of vision. That's something that I don't think we are inherently very good at. We like worrying about certain scenarios. We really are fascinated by the idea of a climate change leading to disaster. And we have an enormous number of conferences about that and policy documents on that subject. I don't in the least deny that that's a danger. And over the next 50 years, it seems pretty probable that rising temperatures will cause all kinds of calamities. But it seems to me also that we are devoting a disproportionate amount of energy and time to that scenario and not enough to others. And these others included, of course, a pandemic. When I first began to realize we were having a pandemic in 2020, right at the beginning, I was at the World Economic Forum, and all that anybody was talking about was climate change. Greta Thunberg was there. We were told that the top global risks the world faced were all climate related. And I was running around the conference hall saying, don't you realize there's a pandemic underway now? And that is really the thing we should be talking about. There are a bunch of other scenarios, some of them quote unquote natural that we're not really giving enough thought to, and some of them obviously technological. And then there are the kind of old geopolitical problems. War is, after pandemics, the biggest killer in history, the biggest cause of excess mortality or premature death. The probability that we end up with a big war between the US and China is not small at the moment. And yet, I'm not sure how much we really think about that. In particular, do we really think about massive cyber attack and a full-blown shutdown of our power grid, of the internet? How would we cope if the cell phones and the email went out and there were no more Zencastr sessions and Zooms for that matter? I strongly suspect that while we know that cyber attacks are a serious problem, and we've had a number of smaller ones to warn us, we're not really properly prepared for that scenario. I don't know of any organization that really has a plan for what they do if the communications are completely down for a significant length of time.
Well, have no fear. If all of that happens, I'll just drive to you and we can do an interview in person.
Well, it's a good strategy to have, because you would definitely need to rely on the internal combustion engine. But what if your car's a Tesla? How far would you get? Say, even if it is a gasoline-style old internal combustion engine, who's to say if the gas stations would actually function in conditions of a major shutdown? Most of the pumps are electronic. To an enormous extent, our society runs on computing power now, and the reality is that a major crisis in our electronic infrastructure would be paralyzing. And it would also, I think, throw us into a considerable amount of chaos. So you might set off in your car to meet with me, but I'm not sure you'd make it.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Tesla, because in the introduction you have a section on Elon Musk and how he responded to the pandemic early on. And you, meanwhile, on February 2nd, 2020, February 2nd, which seems like a million years ago, but it wasn't that long ago, you wrote, quote, "We are now dealing with an epidemic in the world's most populous country, China, which has a significant chance of becoming a global pandemic. The challenge is to resist that strange fatalism that leads most of us not to cancel our travel plans and not to wear uncomfortable masks, even when a dangerous virus is spreading exponentially." What was happening with Elon Musk? What was happening with you in the early days?
Well, I have great respect for Elon Musk as a brilliant man. I know him slightly, not well, but he was one of the many people who was distinctly flip about the virus and the threat that it posed, and used Twitter to suggest that we were all madly overreacting. I was, on the other hand, early on convinced that there was a significant danger of one of history's big pandemics. And I lined up with people like Nassim Taleb and Yanir Bar-Yam and Joe Norman, who in January said, we don't really know much about this, but there's some probability that it's a really bad pandemic and therefore we should take very early action to limit its spread. That was the right approach. And it was kind of a logical consequence of things that people like Larry Brilliant have been saying for years. Larry Brilliant's an epidemiologist who played a big part in the eradication of smallpox. And he did a TED talk in 2005 in which he said the key to a pandemic is early detection and early action. They did that in Taiwan. They did that in South Korea. They did a pretty good job of it in Australia and New Zealand. And we completely screwed it up. So, you know, when I look back on those early discussions, January, February into March, what strikes me is that there was a broad coalition of people who were getting it wrong, both on the left and the right. And Elon was just one of many people who were downplaying the seriousness of the threat. And he was in some pretty bizarre company. Sean Hannity was downplaying it on Fox News. But there were people in the New York Times who were downplaying it. I remember absurd articles in late January when Trump proposed a travel ban on China, one of the few good suggestions that Trump made in his last year as president. And the New York Times and the Washington Post denounced this as xenophobia and motivated by racism, when in fact it was actually quite the right thing to do and it should have been done 2 weeks earlier. So I look back on that time with amazement. It was very hard to find people who saw clearly the danger we were in. And it was pretty much impossible to find those people in the key decision-making agencies, both sides of the Atlantic. There were a few who saw it, credit to someone like Matt Pottinger and the National Security Council. But the overwhelming consensus in Washington, as in London, was let's not rush into drastic measures. It might not be necessary. And that was the very wrong way to play this. It was much better to take drastic measures early and avoid the nationwide spread problem. Because when you ended up postponing the measures that you had to take in mid-March and April were far, far more drastic than the ones you'd have taken in January or early February.
You alluded to something I wanted to bring up, which is something you write about quite a bit in the book. And that's the idea that as tempting as it is to blame, to lay the responsibility for a disaster at the feet of the person at the top, it doesn't always go like that. And you use the example, among others, of the great physicist Richard Feynman and his study of the Challenger. Can you talk about all this? What did he find? We know he's a great physicist, but what does his writing about the disaster of the Challenger tell us about where blame goes?
Well, everyone should read Richard Feynman's account of what went wrong in 1986 when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up. Even if you're too young to remember it, I'm old enough to remember the shocking television footage being aired over again and again over the news. Feynman was called in from Caltech to be part of a commission of inquiry. And he was an oddball, brilliant man who immediately took against the whole approach of the chairman of the inquiry, who was a classic Washington insider, the former Secretary of State, William Rogers. Feynman went off the reservation pretty early on and started wandering around NASA chatting to engineers and asking seemingly innocent questions of the people there. Now, there was a theory right at the beginning when the space shuttle had just blown up that it must somehow be Ronald Reagan's fault. And this is how the press works. You've got to try and pin it on the president if you can. That's how the Washington Post sells papers. So the story was that Reagan had pressed for the launch to be rushed to get a mention of the launch into the State of the Union address. This was a non-story. There was no substance to it at all. What had really happened was completely different. And this was what Feynman found out. Down in the bowels of NASA, the engineers knew that there was a 1%, 1 in 100 chance that the space shuttle would blow up shortly after launch because of fuel leaking from the launch rockets. And they knew the problem, which were the so-called O-rings, these little rings that were supposed to seal the fuel and prevent leakage. And these failed at low temperatures. And it was a low temperature day when they launched the Challenger. So the thing was going to happen sooner or later. I mean, 1%, if you're doing regular launches each year, is a near certainty that at some point there'll be a disaster. But the bureaucrats at NASA turned that into not 1 in 100, but 1 in 100,000. And this was what Feynman established, this switch, which essentially miscommunicated and misrepresented the engineers' warnings, was actuated, as Feynman suggested, by the imperatives of bureaucracy. They didn't want to admit how risky it was because they didn't really want to tell the people funding the space shuttle project in case the funding got cut off. And the same thing, as I found out, because I dug even deeper. Being a historian, not a physicist, I wasn't quite satisfied with Feynman's story, so I dug even deeper into the company that made the booster rockets, the launch rockets. And it turned out that the same thing had happened there, where the engineers are like, this thing is going to blow up. And the guys who were the managers were like, but if we tell them that, we're like totally going to lose the order and they're going to go to the competition. So there was a similar problem within the company that made the rockets. Anyway, why do I tell you this? Because doom is a history of disaster, but it also has a general theory at work. And the general theory is that most disasters, whether you're talking about COVID-19 or World War I or the Battle of the Somme or the blowing up of the Space Shuttle Challenger, are really not caused by an error at the top. The buck stops at the top. Ultimate responsibility clearly lies with the president, just as, and this is your world, Daniel, you know, the conductor is kind of the person who takes responsibility if the orchestra plays bum notes. But in truth, the point of failure is not actually at the top. Most of the time, it's further down the chain of command. And for me, the emblematic figure in the Feynman story was the enigmatic Mr. Kingsbury, who was the bureaucrat that the engineers could never get a meeting with to try to convince him that it really was a 1 in 100 chance. Anyway, I found the story really enlightening, and I had the realization that this might be true of most disasters. And the more I dug into different disasters, the more it began to look that way. I mean, was Gorbachev or whoever was Soviet leader at the time, I think it was Gorbachev, responsible for Chernobyl? No. I mean, it was on his watch. But the true nature of the disaster really lay in the middle management of the Ukrainian Communist Party and the way the engineers were incentivized to behave at the reactor site.
It's so interesting because what you say sounds so sensical, but so shocking at the same time. And how well known is it that 1 in 100 became 1 in 100,000? I mean, does everybody who opens up a textbook in, I don't know, eighth grade or whatever, read that? I wasn't taught that.
No, it's a pity, isn't it? Because it's such a classic moment. It's there in other cases. The Battle of the Somme was really the worst military disaster in British history. It was a completely unsuccessful offensive in 1916 against very well-defended German lines. A colossal number of soldiers were killed, and they gained virtually no territory. And so the question has long been, who was to blame? And it was reasonably easy to blame the commander-in-chief, Douglas Haig, who for many years was a hate figure in Britain. But on close inspection, it was actually junior commanders who could be said to have bungled the operation. And in particular, there was this terrible failure on the part of the artillery to make the preliminary bombardment successful. So in each of the disasters in the book, I kind of drill down to find the point of failure. The Titanic's another good example. It's kind of a long and complicated story, but it's a very different story from the one in the movie, where the problem really rests with the fact that the way the compartments were designed and the hull of the ship meant that if it tilted over, there was no way that the water wouldn't just cascade right through the boat. I could go on. The bottom line, I think, is that we think about disasters in a way that is oversimplified. We want to pin the blame on the person at the top because it somehow obviates the need to understand how complex systems work. And whether we're talking about the public health bureaucracy or the British Army or the workings of a nuclear power station, we are dealing with a complex system in each case. And the point of failure can be pretty much anywhere in the system in some cases, because it's so complex that a relatively small perturbation can cause the whole thing to tip over into chaos. This is the reality of, particularly of modern systems, that we've made them ever more complex and therefore in some ways ever more fragile. It's easier just to say we had excess mortality of 600,000 in the US because Donald Trump is an idiot. This is a terribly easy argument to make, and it's been made time and again in the media over the last year. But the implication is wrong, I think, namely that if someone else had been president, it would have gone so much better. This isn't to defend Trump. He made so many mistakes that it's almost tedious to list them all. But it's an attempt to say to readers, look, if we tell ourselves that we've solved the problem by electing a new president, we thoroughly deserve to have another disaster go just as badly wrong, because we haven't learned the real lesson. And the lesson is that we have in our bureaucratic systems a very serious pathology. And the pathology is that they're good at giving the illusion of preparedness. There was a 36-page pandemic preparedness plan. There was an assistant secretary for preparedness. On paper, the United States was the best prepared country for a pandemic in the world in 2019. And that was the verdict of a report that came from Johns Hopkins and the Economist Intelligence Unit. On paper, we were prepared, but in reality, we weren't at all. And I worry that we're going to miss this point by pinning it all on Trump. He deserves all kinds of criticism, but I don't think he was the real point of failure in what went wrong last year.
It's so interesting you say that, because obviously the next question is, well, then what else went wrong? Obviously, here are other people in January. I'm in Buenos Aires having a great time playing concerts and going to fabulous steakhouses and, you know, seeing tango at 1 a.m. And meanwhile, coming home late at night to my great hotel and looking at these three red hot spots, Italy, Iran, and China, on the map and thinking, this is really weird. But certainly wasn't my job to think it anything else other than this is very weird, and I wonder what's going to happen when I go to New Orleans for Mardi Gras in 2 weeks. So, but there are people whose job it was to implement this 36-page pandemic preparedness book at a minimum. What, take Trump out of the picture. What happened?
Well, we can, in a way, take him out, in the sense that the key mistakes that I think are responsible for the rapid spread of the virus across the United States and the very significant number of deaths in the two great peaks of the spring and then of the holidays period, Thanksgiving to Christmas, these were as follows. First, the Centers for Disease Control totally failed to ramp up testing. That was a disaster that you couldn't pin on Trump, because CDC failed all by itself. They not only prevented other agencies from creating test kits, which they could easily have done, they also produced a testing kit that didn't work. This was a bureaucratic fail at CDC. Second, there was no attempt at contact tracing. The big tech companies didn't even try. They talked about it. But even in April, Google and Apple were just talking about it. And then they decided, I think rather disingenuously, to punt it to the state governments, as if state governments were well equipped to produce contact tracing apps. That was a really important failure. And it meant that we weren't able to do what they did in Taiwan and South Korea, which was very quickly to start testing everybody and figuring out who had the virus, and then actually making sure that they knew who they'd been in contact with. Third big failure. The protection of the elderly was obviously a priority, because you could see, even when you were in Buenos Aires, there was enough research showing that this disease disproportionately killed people over 65 and especially people over 75. And yet we, in many Western countries, in multiple US states, we allowed infected people into elderly care homes. This was what I call senicide in the book, the systematic killing of the elderly. And it was responsible for really large proportions of the deaths last year. in Europe and in the United States. Was that Trump's fault? No, this was more or less all the decision-making of governors, including, but not only, the governor of New York, Mr. Cuomo. And then lastly, we never enforced quarantines in this country. There was never any serious attempt to restrict the movements of people who had been in areas where the virus was already known to be widespread, which meant that people were pouring in from Wuhan and just going wherever they liked right through January and then from Europe long after the virus was on the loose there. So I can't really see how any of that can be attributed to the president. In fact, if anything, at least on the last issue, Trump had the right instinct, which was to try to limit travel from China, even if he left it about 2 weeks too late and wasn't able to enforce the travel ban effectively. So I would say, if you're asking why did we have about 500,000 deaths, that's a big part of the story. And while Trump's increasingly lunatic interventions probably added something to the death toll, it's hard for me to believe that it was more than, let us say, 10%. And putting it differently, if Joe Biden had had the job a year early, I'm not sure we would have done a great deal better. I think even Ron Klain, his chief of staff, would acknowledge that. In 2019, Ron Klain said if 2009, when swine flu struck the United States, had been like 2020, i.e. if swine flu had been as bad as COVID, there would have been a disaster on Obama's watch. And I think that's a really telling point. And it was honest of him to make it. Please don't get me wrong, I'm not defending Trump at all. I think he actually did a shocking job. And it always was in my mind that if there were a crisis, he would screw it up. And he did. But I don't think we should tell ourselves with a different president, we'd have been fine. If we tell ourselves that, the next disaster will be a mess in the same way, whatever it is. I mean, if it's a cyber attack, we won't be prepared for that. If it's an earthquake in San Francisco, yeah, I'm sure there's a great earthquake preparedness plan up in Sacramento. But I'll tell you something, it won't work. There hasn't been a single drill of any kind since I've been in this state, and that's 4.5 years. We're just going to wing it if there's an earthquake. And there will be a big earthquake here at some point. You and I know that. We don't know when. We just need to look very closely at what kind of preparedness plan there is, asking the question, is this plan like the one you had for a pandemic? If it's that kind of a plan, we really don't have a plan. And by the way, Daniel, in the UK, they're beginning to face this. A very interesting thing happened last week. You probably play in London often or used to before the pandemic.
Sure.
Dominic Cummings, the former chief advisor to Boris Johnson, gave some devastating testimony before a parliamentary committee in which he basically said this was a system-wide failure extending from the elected politicians to the civil servants to the public health experts. They all got it wrong. The whole system failed. And I think that's probably true in most Western countries, in most Latin American countries. And it doesn't matter if the president was a populist or the prime minister was a populist or not. The technocrats actually basically performed as badly.
There's a word in the title of the book. I was just looking at it while you were speaking, and I wasn't planning to ask this at all. But you sort of said something that wanted to make me ask you. So the word is politics. And yeah. I think about how political everything got in the pandemic. Obviously, masks, the biggest thing that was a political statement. When David Frum was on a while back, he made an interesting point. He said, look, we have far right in Canada too. He's Canadian. He said, no one in the far right in Canada was not wearing masks. But okay, that happened here in the United States. Masks, vaccines are a big political issue. Many other things were politicized. You're a historian. You've written about plagues. You've written about horrible things over the past millennium. Even in this book, a lot of that's covered. How normal is it for a disaster to be politicized? Is that just what always happens?
It doesn't always happen, but it often happens. Part of the problem is that in a time of disaster, whatever the disaster is, but let's focus on plagues, there's a great deal of psychological anxiety and uncertainty, fear. And under those circumstances, it's not difficult to generate an extreme political reaction. I tell the story of the Black Death in Europe in the mid-14th century, when nobody really understood the nature of the disease. They didn't understand that it was fleas on rats, and they therefore had very confused notions about what was causing this extraordinary level of mortality, where 30 or 40% of people would be dying, if you can imagine that. I mean, staggering levels of premature death.
Aren't there some tales that I think are true in a town where suddenly after a weekend, 50% of the people would be dead?
Yes, it was that catastrophic. And there were European towns that were essentially reduced to ghost towns because the population was so reduced that some cities all but vanished. There were two really extraordinary responses to this, which I describe in the book. One, the flagellant orders. These were men, and they were exclusively male, brotherhoods, fraternities, that would wander from town to town publicly flogging themselves, engaging in flagellation as an act of expiation to ward off further divine wrath. This is something I've long been fascinated by. Norman Cohn writes about it in The Pursuit of the Millennium. The flagellant orders, of course, were not really doing anything to prevent the further spread of the plague. They were probably doing something to spread it, but certainly whipping themselves into a bloody mess was not a major and likely successful intervention. But the other thing that happened was that the Jews were blamed, and there were large-scale attacks on Jewish communities in multiple towns in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. So we have evidence in the Middle Ages that a time of plague is a time when all kinds of violent religious behavior can take place. In 1918-19, when this dreadful influenza called the Spanish influenza struck, some of the things that we saw last year happened. For example, there was an anti-mask league in San Francisco of people protesting against the mandatory wearing of masks in the city. There has long been a kind of crazy streak in American culture of hostility to vaccination, going all the way back to the very earliest days of so-called variolation against smallpox. So we've sometimes, maybe I should say often, seen this, but not always. One of the things that really struck me when I was writing the history of the 1957-58 Asian flu was that there was really no politicization of vaccines at that point. People were very glad that the United States led the world in vaccine development and manufacture, and they couldn't wait to get the vaccine when it was made available. It wasn't a partisan issue. And I think the thing that's really interesting to me is that compared with the 1950s, we've allowed partisan concerns to invade the realm of public health to a much greater extent than they did then. Now, politicization is a dangerous thing. Not everything is politics. Is music politics? Is there a kind of Republican version of how to play the 1812 overture versus a Democratic version? No, I don't think so. Tell me if I'm wrong.
I will just say that I didn't think music was politics until this year, and suddenly, apparently, music is politics, and I've been pushing back on that hard because it's news to me. But yes, music is politics now, Niall Ferguson, I hate to tell you.
Well, I don't find that surprising, Daniel, and I knew I was asking a naive question, because wokeism in all its different forms will leave no discipline untouched. And it's only a matter of time before the repertoire has to be entirely recast in order to be more diverse.
It's already happening, my friend.
I see it happening, and I feel a dread of what this will do to the programs at the great opera houses. But there we are. The process of politicization now seems to me to be out of control, and it's driven by the right and by the left. It's propelled by social media. It is a kind of cultural revolution which serves the interests of those people who push it, But part of what I'm trying to argue in Doom is beware of politics. It is actually politics that can turn crop failure into a famine that kills millions. It's politicization of disaster that gets in the way of rational response. And if there's one thing I would love readers to take away from the book, it is a sense that politics needs to be confined to its appropriate domain and not allowed to spill over into every other domain. At the same time, politics should not be conflated with religion. And I see that happening too, where essentially people conduct politics as if it is a kind of religious crusade, where you no longer have opponents, you have heretics and blasphemers who have to be cast out. This is a very dangerous feature of our times, and I think it did not make our response to disaster go better. It made it go much worse. I think that if you turn wearing a mask into a partisan statement, like wearing a MAGA hat, you've left science behind, and you've actually returned us to a time of magic. And I think there's a lot of magical thinking out there masquerading as scientific thinking, and it's deeply, deeply harmful.
You know, when you said before is music politics, I always thought to myself, this past year, especially past few years, well, music is the one thing that will never be touched by any of this. And of course, it was very naive to think. And of course, I thought to myself, well, what could be wrong with playing a Beethoven symphony? I mean, maybe you could say you don't like the attitude of Wagner, you don't like some portrayals of an Asian country in a Puccini opera, to which I would say it's wonderful, period. And you certainly don't have to see the opera if you don't like it. But still, Mozart, you'd think would be immune, but it's not. And so, for example, there's a music school in New York who has literally banned the teaching of a few piano pieces of Debussy because the names have been deemed to be offensive. And the New York Philharmonic got rid of an all Beethoven program for the next season opening in favor of all female composers who wrote works inspired by Beethoven. Now, that's not to say that those pieces shouldn't be played, because perhaps they could be great pieces, but it seems to me to be a very odd way of dealing with a cultural presentation. it's almost saying that these people really, they'd be nothing without Beethoven. So it's kind of a funny thing to do. But in any case, Neil Ferguson, you're free in your home, at least for now, to listen to anything you want. And you're free to talk to me about any music you want. What is music to you? What do you listen to?
I'm so glad we've got to music. And by the way, I share your reaction. The mathematicians thought that it wouldn't come for them, and then it did. And it's essentially spread out from the humanities departments in universities to every sphere of life. My old friend Andrew Sullivan said we all live on campus now. And it's true. There's a sense that you're kind of going to contend with these issues, whether you're a musician, a mathematician, whether you went into the financial world or the media world, there's no escaping it, even if you're a sportsman. So I want to hold out against the politicization of music. I'm a very eclectic person when it comes to music. I grew up in a rather unmusical household. My parents were not greatly interested in music. There were, I think, two vinyl LPs in our home, and they were both movie soundtracks. But oddly, for some strange reason, I had some musical leanings. I'm not sure talent's the word, but I wanted to do music in some shape or form. But I was an autodidact. My parents were not the kind of parents who could force me successfully into piano lessons. That didn't last long. But I taught myself to play the guitar as a teenager. Had a period of punk rock in the late 1970s when I was more inspired by the Sex Pistols than by anything else. But that rapidly then mutated into a general interest in not just rock music, but then jazz. I took a kind of great detour in my musical life into bebop and modern jazz when I was a university student. Took up the double bass, so I play a bigger instrument than you. I play it pretty unprofessionally, but I've played jazz on and off for close to 30 years now in a band that calls itself A Night in Tunisia, in homage to the great Parker Gillespie number.
Sure.
And so music,
where is that in Palo Alto? Is that where that band is?
No, it's a British based band, because the majority of members never left. This all began in Oxford back in the 1980s, and it's kept going through thick and thin, even though we can't rehearse or play very often. We've vowed not to give up, and so there is this element of amateur music in my life, and I do think that it's a tremendously good thing to play music, even if you can't play it to the highest level. One of the things I loved about my time in Germany as a graduate student was the ubiquity of chamber music, and the fact that music was not something merely played by the brilliant professionals like you, but was something that one could play at home. So I'm kind of a devoted amateur musician. I don't play well, but I don't think that you need to play perfectly well to make music. And to make music in any ensemble is immensely good for your psyche. So that's part of my musical story. The other part of my musical life is that at some point, I think at Oxford, I began seriously to appreciate classical music, and in particular opera, had a great sort of surge of listening and opera attendance, became a Wagnerian. The pandemic was an opportunity to really get to grips with composers that I'd previously failed with. And the two that I really began to understand properly were Bruckner and Mahler. And I set aside time deliberately to listen to all of their symphonies and understand them, and played to them to myself repeatedly as I worked on Doom. Doom is a Bruckner-Mahler propelled book because I can write and listen to music at the same time. And it was, I don't think I'd ever have done it, Daniel, if it hadn't been that I had 12 months in Montana without any distractions and the chance to properly grasp the point of those composers. I'm probably still in the kind of foothills of understanding, but it felt like a great achievement to work my way through all the Mahler symphonies, having really kind of bounced off them in my earlier life. It's a bit like reading Proust, which I finally got around to. But yeah, I mean, I became completely obsessed with Mahler 8. I listened to it night after night as the last kind of thing I did. In an amazing recording by the Philadelphia Orchestra with Yannick Nézet-Séguin as the conductor. Must have listened to that about 20 or 30 times. And so it's been a great opportunity to engage in some late musical education.
I love hearing all that. And one thing I've always told people about this period is that I hope that the good things that we did in this period, like listening to a lot more music, like actually sitting down and hearing it over and over and over, because great music bears repeated listening. I hope the good things we can retain in the same way that you want maybe a restaurant to keep the outdoor seating on that corner that you really liked. You know, why take it away now? I hope that the serious good things that brought us pleasure, born out of necessity, we can keep doing because our lives are so much richer by listening to music by ourselves at home. We all love live concerts, and we all love playing and going to concerts, but there's nothing like being in your home and sitting on the couch or the favorite chair and letting it wash over you over and over again.
And I think it actually means that when you go to the concert, you have a more rewarding experience. I do think that when I began my Mahler journey, it was actually it was actually a performance of one of the symphonies at La Scala Milan. And I realized that there was something here of tremendous importance that I needed to study, but I needed that time at home with recordings to begin to understand the structures of the symphonies. And now when I go back to hear live performance, I won't be so bemused and bewildered as I was. So I think this is a key development. If we're honest, the past year has created all kinds of psychological problems. We have a great wave of mental illness that is going on, and young people are particularly affected. These are amongst the unintended consequences of lockdowns. And I've been trying to communicate to my kids and other young people that one of my coping strategies and one of the things that really helped me psychologically was to take music even more seriously and set myself musical goals. More recently, I decided to work my way through the Beethoven piano sonatas. Sorry, I should really have picked a cello pieces.
At all, but I decided 32 piano sonatas and 5 cello sonatas, so you picked a bigger project.
I wanted to kind of listen to a new recording, so I went to Brendel's recordings, and that again was a chance to listen deeply, particularly to the later sonatas. And I found myself talking about these issues with friends more, comparing notes with friends about which particular recordings seemed the most transcendent. The cello is an instrument I have a curious relationship with. Maybe this is true of all double bass players. You kind of know that the cello is just the cooler instrument. So there's a slight sort of cello envy. Plus, my sister played the cello when she was a girl, and I always felt slightly one down. But Yo-Yo Ma's been somebody I've listened to a lot, and I've enjoyed some of his more experimental forays into territory that I think was unfamiliar to most of us. The Silk Road albums that he did were a really big influence on my thinking when I was doing a lot of Asia traveling and research. So in the end, it all comes back to, does it all come back in the end to the Bach cello sonatas? Maybe it does. And every double bass player would secretly like to be able to play them on the double bass, but it's too difficult. At least I couldn't even begin to. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, music is definitely not politics, and it should not be politicized. And we should remember all those battles that they had back in the 19th and early 20th century on these issues. Think of Thomas Mann and Nietzsche arguing about Wagner. I think the most important thing about Wagner is that you can loathe the man's thoughts and politics and adore the music, and that is okay. So I'm somebody who thinks that psychological equipoise is impossible without music, and that we have got to try much, much harder to make music accessible and available, particularly to young people. If it becomes too narrow a demographic that enjoys the great music of past centuries, this will be a terrible civilizational failure. Anything that we can do to get people to realize that this is the best medication and the safest medication for your psychological troubles is a good thing.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And very sadly, kids and even adults who are in the middle age or later years who've never heard classical music, they often fall in love with it absolutely to a T, even if they have no background, no knowledge. And it's the people oftentimes, as has been shown over and over and over, in these sort of musicological positions who are saying, no, Beethoven is elitist for these reasons. And they create the problems that actually don't exist. And it's absolutely maddening, especially for someone like me who simply wants more and more people to love music, which was a big part of why I started this podcast, actually.
Well, the key here is that there are the elitists and then there are the popularizers. And I think you and I are popularizers. I've always thought that history should be a mass market subject, that history does not require a PhD. And on the contrary, that history is something that everybody should have some understanding of. It's why I did a lot of television about 10 years ago and still try to use television to get to that wider audience. But yeah, I mean, I think that one has to be a little ingenious and maybe even resort to trickery to get young people to open their ears. I used to drag my older children to operas and they would complain and grumble as I would drag them from Oxford to Covent Garden. But my daughter, who's now 26, said to me the other day, well, she first revealed that she'd been to the opera entirely on her own initiative. And then it became clear that this was part of a pattern. And she said, you know, it was strange that you would drag us and we grumbled, but actually you planted this seed that then later sprouted. And I do think that there's a parental mandate that not everybody fully appreciates. You got to drag your children along to concerts. And I used to try to, when I lived in Cambridge, go to hear the Boston Symphony Orchestra. But I remember the horror when I was told that I couldn't actually take a child as young as 3 or 4 to hear the major programs that they were performing. And I thought, God, there's no better way to get a 3-year-old into music than to take them to hear an orchestra performing Beethoven. And it's not enough to say, but he can come to the Christmas concert.
No.
I think we do need to make it more accessible. Parents, take your kids when they're young. It's an exhilarating experience for a young child to hear an orchestra in full flow. And we should make it easier for parents to do that. Put up with some noise in the matinee performances. You're planting seeds that will really flourish later.
I think that is absolutely beautifully said. And I fell in love with cello when I was 4 and a half, but I was certainly brought to concerts and operas earlier than that. And then later on, even in middle school, I had just wonderful experiences. My mom would drive me down from New Hampshire, take me out of school and bring me to open rehearsals of the Boston Symphony. And there's nothing like being up close when you're a young person, seeing the machinations of a rehearsal and seeing, yes, these are real people, not just statues wearing white tie and tails, and they're real people doing real jobs, and maybe that can be you. And it's so important to not overestimate the capacity and not underestimate the capacity of a kid, but just bring them there and see what happens. And not tell them that it's some complicated thing and not assume that they won't get it or will get it, but let them listen for themselves.
Daniel, I have a question for you. And it's about how you get children started in playing music. I'm a father of 5 children, and I haven't really succeeded in getting any one of them yet to take off, to achieve musical escape velocity, though I've pushed them through piano lessons one after the other. I feel like I must be doing it wrong. And as somebody who kind of taught himself music and looks back and regrets not having been properly trained, I'd so love one of my children to get this right. What's the best way, in your experience, to get a child started on a musical path? Am I wrong to start with piano, which I've done 4 times out of 5? I'm looking at my 3-year-old and asking the question, are you two going down this route of mandatory piano lessons that will bring us into conflict on a weekly or more than weekly basis? What's your tip? I'm sure people listening would love to hear your thoughts on this.
That's an interesting question first of all, if it didn't work for 4, maybe you should give the 3-year-old a cello when he turns 4. The cello, first of all, is a very nice instrument for a little kid to play because it's easy. You just sit there. You don't have to learn a very convoluted position for the left hand like you do for a violin. And there's some novelty in it. The friends will come over after school and wonder what that is, and that'll add to the appeal factor. But in terms of liking the instrument enough to keep with it, I think that the kid really just has to love music, and the kid has to love the feel of the instrument. And it could be that your kids had an affection for music or piano, but not both. And ideally, the physicality of the instrument matches the emotional appeal that the music itself gives. So they actually like holding, I'll just use the cello, they like holding the bow. They like the way the ribs of the instrument feel as they press into the inner part of the knee. They like that the scroll almost rests on their left shoulder, but doesn't quite. That sort of huggy feeling that you get when you are playing the cello. That's so appealing to a kid. I mean, the piano is of course the great bass instrument. It's the fountain from which all the music ever written can be played. But there's something viscerally appealing about the cello. I really think.
Yeah, I can relate to that, and I certainly never got on with the piano. It was only once I started stringed instruments that I began to find a way into music. So I think you've given me a brilliant idea, which is to find a very small cello to get young Campbell started, and perhaps also give his big brother something else to mess around with. It may just be that the Fergusons aren't pianists, and it's time to face that fact.
I'll tell you where to go offline in the Bay Area, and I'll find you a great teacher as well out there, actually.
I'm in. I think we got to try something different with the youngest, and I would love him to be inspired by you to think that actually this is the instrument, and it would also be easier in the ears than violin. We all know that beginner violin is one of the world's most painful sounds, and that is not true of beginner cello. I know because I had to listen to my sister practice.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to sound like Rostropovich immediately, but it's still not quite as
no.
Painful.
But it doesn't sound like some murderous act being perpetrated against a living creature, which is how the violin can sound.
Neil Fergusson, let me just ask you to zoom out and offer some advice to us. I just offered some to you. Now offer some to me and the people listening. We have this book here called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. We've heard what you've been saying. As we look forward, what can people like me and you, non-professionals, we're not government employees, we don't really run a big bureaucracy or even work in one that's going to affect any of this, but what can the ordinary citizen going about their day, we're busy, we're getting back to life, everything like that. What can, should we be doing? What should be reading? What conversations should we be having to get better?
I think the most important thing we need to do is to come to terms with the randomness and unpredictability of disaster. And it can strike you at the micro level. We all have a confident assumption that we'll make it into our 70s or 80s, but actually that's a wrong assumption to live with. You must be prepared for disaster to strike you even at the most intimate level, and illness in the family. And so psychologically one must be prepared for that and recognize that it is in fact the nature of life that arbitrarily and it will seem unfairly. Someone close to you, perhaps yourself, will be prematurely struck down. Psychologically, we're not well prepared for that. We have not, as a society and as a civilization, at all prepared ourselves for personal or societal disaster. We've become overconfident in our longevity. And this means that we're very fragile and vulnerable when disaster strikes. If we can take anything out of the horrible plague year of 2020-21, it is that, and that we need to be more resilient, even if we can't be anti-fragile, because what doesn't kill us doesn't necessarily make us stronger, it can make us weaker. We can at least be more resilient. And I think this involves a very different way of thinking about the future than we've grown accustomed to. We want lots of calculable risk and insurance policies against the risk, but we have to recognize that a really big part of our lives is dominated by uncertainty, by things to which we can't attach probabilities. And we need to be a little bit quicker on our feet, knowing that we won't have a model that predicts with any precision when the next big upheaval strikes. What one needs to cultivate, I think, is a nimbleness, a rapidity of reaction, and a readiness, I talk about this in Doom, to change our behavior if there is some new and fast-moving threat, not to feel self-conscious about it, not to feel self-conscious about wearing a mask in the early stages of a respiratory pandemic. So I think we need to train ourselves as individuals, and not only as individuals, as communities, as families, to be ready to deal with any rapidly changing state of affairs that is threatening, and not to sit waiting for the government to tell us what to do. Because I think that mentality is also a recipe for magnified disaster. Let's think about what can go wrong in the next 10 years. It could take all kinds of different shapes and sizes. Wildfires and earthquakes are two here in California we need to worry about. But how well prepared really are you as an individual or as a family or as a street for that kind of disaster? Did you ever really run that simulation, do a drill? So that's what I would call the sort of slightly different psychology that we need to cultivate. I'm not saying that you need to stock up on canned food and ammunition. We're not all going to be preppers, but I do think you need to think a bit differently about risk. And 2020 has been sent to teach you to think differently about risk and uncertainty. But let me conclude with the good news. As you and I have just been describing and discussing, there are lots of things that we can do to offset this risk and uncertainty and make it easier to cope with. And one of those things is to immerse ourselves more systematically in music and in literature. Let me break a lance for my own book writing activity. Reading is something that people don't do enough of, or they read the wrong kind of thing, doom scrolling their way through Twitter. I've derived almost as much solace from reading the novels of Walter Scott and Proust in the last 18 months as I have from listening to Bruckner and Mahler. So I think the great thing about this disastrous year is that it's given those of us who've come through it, and that's, of course, the vast majority of people, a chance to live better, to live more awarely, to be more reactive and responsive to threats, but also to manage our psychologies better through music and literature rather than medication.
Wise words, Neil Ferguson. Manage our psychologies better through music and literature rather than through medication. What a perfect stopping point. And I thank you so much, and I hope there's a chance to do this again. There's a lot more to cover, and I sure look forward to it.
What I'm looking forward to, Daniel, is coming to hear you perform. And I'm going to make a point of looking for a live performance when one is close to me or I am close to it, because it would just be thrilling after this conversation to see you do your stuff, preferably in an auditorium or at a festival. And I hope this year.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.